Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. We've looked at elections viewing from perspectives ranging from allegations of interference from foreign nations or violations of campaign laws to the effect divisions are having upon our democracy. All important topics, but those are discussions for another night. Tonight we make a status check and take a look at how we got here. Several months ago, I predicted two things, each looking crazy at the time: that the election could eventually be decided in Pennsylvania, that our next president could well be Nancy Pelosi. One of my learned guests saw these and many of the issues of the day, such as that the election is already being contested. The battleground states are the very states whose votes are the most vulnerable to legal challenge. Is it conceivable that entire states could be disenfranchised? The dispute could create a constitutional crisis for which there's no clear solution. Congress could end up picking our next president. And finally, Nancy Pelosi could be sworn in as acting president and remain until all issues are resolved. Meanwhile, while all eyes are on the presidential election, there are other issues deserving attention that are being swept under the rug, such as different industries seemingly bought several propositions, or at least the outcomes of these propositions. Did the bail industry succeed in buying enough votes? Uber and Lyft spent more money to protect their turf than any proposition in the nation's history. Did it work? Who were the forces protecting their investment interest from property tax increases? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind, and to answer your questions tonight is no exception. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that is yesterday's elections. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. As always, my guests are happy to share with you their expertise, to answer your general and legal questions, to lend guidance in this variable time to this very vital area. However, even attorneys have to stop short of giving you precise legal advice on your case, as we don't have sufficient information about the specifics of your case. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And again, we'll pay the freight. Call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Let me, without further ado, introduce tonight's guests. A practicing attorney and frequent guest and co-host for this program, Dean Johnson has worked as a legal analyst for the last 15 years. His credits include numerous appearances on NBC, ABC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, BBC, Australian Broadcasting Company, and National Public Radio. Dean's commentary has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, the San Francisco Chronicle, and People Magazine. Bradley Hertz is a partner at the Sutton Law Firm, formerly an adjunct professor teaching election law and civil procedure at Chapman University School of Law. Brad Hertz is a past president of the California Political Attorneys Association and author of several articles, most recently, Democracy in the Time of COVID-19. Particularly timely given yesterday's election and the scrutiny that's now underway. And with that, Brad, Dean, welcome once again to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much.
It's great to be here tonight.
You know, it's hard to know where to start in light of the elections that are currently underway, but I guess it's safe to say that these elections are already being contested, are they not?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, most of us who are listening remember the 2000 election where one state, Florida, was being contested, and that happened after the election process. The fact is, this particular election has been contested for weeks and months. There are currently 19 cases, at least, and there have been several more filed today that contest this election process. So this is going to think of this as Bush versus Gore on steroids.
Brad, you looked like you were ready to speak.
Sure. I would take a slightly different view. And I think, you know, as much as we've had a perfect storm leading up to yesterday's election, Bush versus Gore was an even more perfect storm in the sense that it did come down to one state, that there was a recount, and that there were issues as to how the various hanging chad were being looked at and counted, and equal protection issues relative to various counties. Here, I think because even though you have a lot of litigation, assuming we get a winner declared with 270 electoral votes in the next couple of days, it may not lead to a showdown in the U.S. Supreme Court as we saw 20 years ago.
Although, from my perspective, while the Supreme Court appears less likely to want to act on any of these cases, the fact is there's a whole litany of cases because, unlike the time of Bush versus Gore, where they were really talking about one state and one or two issues, here there's multiple cases in multiple places fighting just about every variable you could imagine.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, there is a pattern to a lot of these cases that I think does make it a perfect storm, and it has to do with COVID. Several of these cases that are pending either in the Supreme Court or on the way to the Supreme Court involve court-created extensions of deadlines that were intended to accommodate the pressures that were put on the process by COVID. And it's those very extensions that are now being challenged in court. And people who relied on those extensions faced the possibility of having their votes disenfranchised. And it's a huge problem because there is lurking in these cases a problem that we've come to know as the Kavanaugh footnote, which comes from Justice Kavanaugh's footnote in a recent case where he said, look, I don't think any court has the right to extend or change or modify a voting deadline of any kind. I think the Constitution makes that the exclusive province of the state's legislatures. And there are several cases, including cases in all of the key battleground states that raise those issues. But you're right, Jeff, there are a number of other issues being raised. In Pennsylvania, for example, there is a suit that attacks what's been called the naked ballot. And remember that term, because the naked ballot may become this year's hanging chad.
And I would add that, you know, history sometimes repeats itself, and time will only tell how these lawsuits will wind their way through the courts. But a couple of things to keep in mind. Democracy is extremely resilient. We haven't seen the alleged fraud that we were told we might see, or the civil unrest, thank goodness, or foreign interference. And as messy as democracy is, I think and I hope it will be resilient and we'll get a clear winner and life will go on.
It was interesting. Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this whole process has been a tremendous stress test for democracy. And institutions need a stress test from time to time. And as I've said a couple of times, if there is any silver lining to the cloud of the last 4 years of this election process, it's that we realize that from time to time, democracy needs a revival. It has now been confirmed that Joe Biden received more votes than any presidential candidate in history. That means a lot of people are participating in democracy. And I think people are going to begin to realize as this process unwinds that voting is not the be-all and end-all of your citizenship. You have got to be actively involved in order to preserve your democracy and your democratic institutions. And people are getting actively involved on both sides in a good way, not in a way of going out into the streets and creating civil unrest, but getting involved in the institutions and in the process. And that, if there's anything that's good that's going to come out of that, that's it.
I found a striking contrast between listening to President Trump last night and listening to former Vice President Biden last night. Vice President Biden maintains that he believes that when all the votes are counted, he will have enough votes based on what's already been declared, as opposed to the president who spoke and said he's won states that have not been declared and that every vote that's counted since is an effort to try to take away and steal his victory and to invalidate the votes of the people in favor of him. It was rather remarkable. And from where I sit, I found it rather refreshing, only in the sense that I think we finally reached the high watermark and that maybe with a moderate Democrat president, a very small, slim majority Republican Senate, we can get people that are capable of talking to each other and maybe start to heal some of the wounds. I don't know how you feel about that.
I was quite astonished with the president's comments last night, and I thought I was kind of past that point of being able to be surprised or disappointed. But, you know, the thought that votes counted after election night were somehow illegal and that people were being disenfranchised or should be disenfranchised was really quite shocking. And as an election lawyer, for the president to say that the process was an embarrassment to our country, it reminded me when you point the finger at someone, three fingers are pointing back at you. And for him to treat the sacred nature of our democratic process in that way and basically leave before the ninth inning is over and try to shut everything down was another reason why I think we're on the right path with a new president.
Yeah, I as a journalist, I listened to that statement and I was right along with my fellow journalist sitting there with my mouth open saying, what universe is this man living in? And I think it really pointed up the fact that there are people who are out there that comprise possibly almost half of our electorate, maybe more, who are really living in a different world after 4 years. They see things through a different lens, through the lens of Donald Trump. And those people are different, and they are committed, and they are going to vote, and they're passionate about their candidate. I think this whole election process, the last couple of days, has been a lesson in hubris for those of us who live in the bright blue states. We kind of, I think, all subliminally expected that people were going to see the error of their ways and abandon Donald Trump, and there was going to be a blue tsunami. That hasn't happened. We've got a very divided country right now. And I think the mission, as Bradley and as you said, Jeff, is to reach out and to find common goals and to start talking about the common good and realize that though we may disagree with something, we may not like their lifestyle or their religious views or something about their culture, that we still have something in common. We all live in a democracy.
Well,
and we all have many, many things that we can do together.
We have a caller that I'm going to go to in just a second, but I will just add to what you were saying. It seems that for the past 20 years, we've seen the pendulum swings start getting wider and wider and going from one extreme to the other. And as that was taking place, more and more individuals are surrounding themselves in enclaves of people who think like they do, reinforcing their opinions instead of looking to what other people may be saying and thinking, even to the extent of watching news outlets of people that are similarly minded to the exclusion of any others, so that they continually reinforce these ideas and it's polarized us. And this may be a very hopeful outcome if we're ever going to come together. This may be the best path forward. Let me turn it to Kolya from San Francisco. Welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, I've been a big watcher of the BBC, and there was somebody on there, I don't remember who it is, but they mentioned not to worry about Trump's wanting to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because to what they were mentioning is that the circuit, you know, the regular district circuit courts, then you have the next level after you go through them, which is the appellate courts, and finally the Supreme Court. And he said that he would think, because this is so obviously a blatant disregard for, constitutional issues here, that if Trump tried to go even to start in the circuit court, the judge, him or her, would probably recuse and throw out the case. And I would like to hear the commentary about that.
Let me turn it over to my guest. But before I do, my own two cents worth that I want to throw out there is I think they may have not understood how we have really dual judicial systems at play. One is in the individual states in which these votes are being cast, the other being in a federal system. And the likelihood is I would think such a challenge would be far more likely to proceed state by state. And then when it reaches the top court of a given state to be challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court, rather than going through the federal court system. Do you agree? Brad, I'll turn it to you first.
Yeah, I just want to say that probably would make it a very long time issue if that were to happen.
This is Brad Hertz. Thank you for your question. And I just turned to the BBC's website, and I see U.S. election on a knife edge is in the Financial Times with both candidates holding their hands up in victory. But I think unlike Bush v. Gore, where the process made its way through the Florida courts and up to the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think President Trump is going to have any success in knocking on the U.S. Supreme Court's door, even with some friendly appointees, and saying, jump in and stop this election or declare me the winner. Hopefully the justices are first and foremost justices and only secondarily political appointees. They have an institution to protect, and I think they would be terribly tainted if they jumped in prematurely or acted in a way that was against precedent.
I've noted that Chief Justice Roberts seems to be rather studious and looking at the fairly recent history of Bush versus Gore and is very concerned about protecting the institution and has said publicly in response to comments of President Trump that there are no such things anymore as Republican justices and Democratic justices. Rather, we have Supreme Court justices. Dean, how do you feel about this one?
Well, I think this is ultimately going to wind up in a Supreme Court in one posture or another. It's not going to be Donald Trump just going and knocking on the door. The cases are going to wind their way through the state systems or the federal systems. They're already in the system, and there are cases that are working their way up through every one of the states where the races are close. What may happen, however, and I think this may be the if there's a secret strategy behind what Trump is doing, I think Trump may be hoping to delay things as much as possible. The reason why he would do that is to actually get beyond the election itself and get to the Electoral College, which is the group of electors that we all vote for that ultimately decide who's going to be president. The current projections, if Donald Trump keeps all the states that he's won or is projected to win, and that if Joe Biden does the same thing, the electoral votes would stand at the end of the day with Joe Biden having 270 votes, just enough to win in the Electoral College. Once things go to Congress and the Electoral College, then there's a procedure where the two houses of Congress decide whether to accept all votes. If one of those 370 electoral votes is rejected, which they very well could be, and there could be a fight in the Supreme Court about when you can reject an electoral vote or not, but if one of those 370 votes is lost, then Joe Biden doesn't have a majority in the Electoral College. You have to have a majority in Electoral College in order to be named president. If he fails to get a majority, then the United States Congress, the House of Representatives, chooses the president. And we would say, oh, well, there's a majority in the House of Representatives for Democrats. That means that Joe Biden gets elected. Not necessarily. When we get to that posture, the Congress votes by delegation, each state delegation has one vote, and if the makeup of the Congress stays as it is right now, 26 delegations belong to the Republicans. Donald Trump, despite having lost in the Electoral College, despite having lost the popular vote, Donald Trump becomes president of the United States.
If I can just add into that, I think you meant to say 270, but you accidentally said 370. But in that regard, a little part of Nebraska could be pivotal because, unlike most states, instead of being winner take all, the electoral votes are divided based on districts or counties. And the Vice President Biden received one of that state's five electoral votes. So to the extent he gets 270 exactly, it will be not in small part to one region of Nebraska that includes Omaha.
Yeah, and you've got, remember, all of this process that I've just described occurs under a 130-year-old statute whose key sentence is 275 words long, whose key terms are not even defined, and which statute may itself be unconstitutional. So we could go to the Supreme Court through that route. If we do that, the Supreme Court may say, you know, we, the Supreme Court, disagree with the way Congress is handling this. Congress could turn around and say, well, thanks for your advice, but we're a separate branch of government. We don't care what you say, at which point we have two branches of government at loggerheads over who's going to run the third branch of government. For that, there is no legal solution.
In that case, and it's still unsettled, who wakes up in the White House on January 21st?
Good question. One of my friends, Lawrence Douglas, who teaches politics at Amherst, has envisioned a scenario on January 20th where, say, Justice Roberts is swearing in Donald Trump at one inauguration ceremony. Justice Sotomayor is swearing in Nancy Pelosi at another one. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett would be swearing in Joe Biden at a third. It has almost happened. There was actually an election back in the 19th century where this happened, where there was a dispute over the Electoral College. And in fact, the two candidates, Tilden and Hayes, were actually planning parallel inaugurations until things got decided by a backroom political deal, which arguably saved the constitutional order. But there was a price for that deal. And the price for that deal was that federal troops withdrew from the Reconstruction South. That led to Jim Crow laws and 100 years of segregation, and we're still suffering from the consequences of that deal. Sometimes these deals, even though they might settle the short-term problem, have very, very long-term and very serious consequences, and that might be where we're headed.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, your host. Tonight, we're discussing yesterday's elections, both state and local, with Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson and past president of the California Political Attorneys Association, Bradley Hertz. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking elections. You don't have to join right where we are, where we are in our conversation. You can muster enough to call. Everybody has a stake in what's going on. Most of us slept 2 or 3 hours last night. Give us a call. Vent a little bit. Our number again is 866-798-8255. Dean, you commented on the deal that was brokered in 1876 between the person who was actually projected to win, the richest man in the colonies, Samuel Tilden, and Rutherford B. Hayes, in what was in many ways a prelude to what could have been the next Civil War. The backdoor deal ended Reconstruction. But that wasn't the first of those types of backdoor deals. Wasn't it a similar deal that created the Electoral College in the first place?
This has been going on for quite some time. I spoke about the possibility of, say, Trump being elected by the House of Representatives in what we refer to as a contingent election. And the fact of the matter is our first elections were pretty wild and woolly. Two of our most famous presidents, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, were not elected by the voters. They were elected by contingent election by the Congress. And in fact, it was this concern that elections would get wild, that they would become sort of a mob rule. Mob rule would be the rule of the day, that led to the Electoral College. And the assumption back in the day was that the Electoral College would be composed of well-respected gentlemen, and they used the term gentlemen, of the community, and they would all be people of good repute and good morals, and that this would eliminate the game playing. Problem is, between the Electoral College and the Electoral Counting Act of 1887, which came out of the Tilden-Hayes Compromise, this is just ripe for game playing. And I suspect very strongly that Trump has his game plan. He's talked from time to time about reaching the Congress and the fact that he has a majority in the Congress if there's a convention election. I suspect that there are equally clever people on Biden's side who can game this out as well.
Brad, let me shift gears a little bit. We've been talking about the presidential election. The whole world is watching the presidential election. But in California, we had a local election of our own at the same time. And some pretty remarkable things have been happening that didn't get any play. For example, the sheer amount of money that was spent this time around was astronomical. If there's any listener who hasn't seen an ad on Prop 22, or an ad talk about whether people should be released on bail, or whether their property tax benefits of Prop 13 should extend to their commercial property. If somebody hasn't seen one of those ads, I would very much like to hear from you and learn how you've avoided seeing or hearing one of those. But where's all this going, Brad, on the state level, and how do we get a handle on it?
Thank you, Jeff. From the California perspective, there are a number of things to comment on. One is if the Biden-Harris ticket prevails, we will once again have, I think, more clout as Californians because the vice president will, of course, be from California, in addition to making history as the first woman and the first woman of color to be vice president. So that will be an interesting California connection. In terms of ballot measures, there were a dozen measures. Many of them were retreads of earlier measures. Prop 21, for example, about rent control was kind of a redo of Prop 10 from 2 years ago. And then you saw, in addition, measures about affirmative action and measures regarding kidney dialysis. Direct democracy is a very interesting thing because I don't know that it has turned out the way the framers in the progressive era thought it would, but you know, money can get measures on the ballot by virtue of signature gathering and lawyers drafting measures. So we did see Prop 22, which was an interesting confluence of events. You had a court case called the Dynamex case that gave more rights to workers to be employees as opposed to independent contractors. You then had legislation, Assembly Bill 5, that codified that. And then you had Uber and Lyft and others wanting to go back to the way it was with independent contractors funding a ballot measure that prevailed.
Let me interrupt you there. We need to take a break for just a moment. And then I'd like to come back and continue this discussion of the local measures. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Yeah. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
One thing I noticed with some of the propositions you were discussing is some of them appear to be one thing on the surface, and voters are voting on what appears on the surface, but the real battle is something else. Do you want to take it from there?
Sure. And that is one of the confusing aspects. When you're looking at a candidate, it's difficult perhaps to know what they're really about, but it's one person with a platform and you can make a decision. When you're talking about a ballot measure, sometimes these are dozens and dozens of pages long. You have an impartial analysis and a title and summary from the state, which may or may not be impartial. You have ballot arguments, and then you have all of the advertising. Thanks to the First Amendment, there is not really a truth in advertising requirement. So certain issues can be emphasized, and you can have a wolf in sheep's clothing. One example for some people was Prop 19, which talked about property tax exemptions if you're over 55 or meet other criteria and are moving houses. You can keep your lower tax property tax base or basis. But then also part of that was if you try to bequeath your home to your children after you die, they would have to pay a higher property tax based on market rate unless they move in. I think it was within a year. So you often get multi-tentacled ballot measures and people aren't quite sure how to vote. The more confusing they are, the more often people vote no, and therefore it's difficult to get a ballot measure passed, which makes 22 kind of remarkable.
Some of the other things I found on the ballot measures, one of them was ostensibly about health care, but it was actually about labor. One had to do with protecting one type of property tax payor vis-a-vis another. And yet it didn't sound like that's really what the debates were about.
That's where the voter is responsible for kind of separating the wheat from the chaff. And we get those voter pamphlets in our mailbox. They're 200 pages long. And I often lead fora, this time I did by Zoom, not telling people how to vote, but trying to explain what the ballot measures really do. And providing a methodology. Let's look at who the sponsors are and who the funders are and who the signers of the ballot arguments are. And that sometimes helps to decipher what's really going on with a measure.
You know, one of the great problems of the First Amendment, the Citizens United problem, is how economic power can often distort the marketplace of ideas. And I think that really goes on in our state propositions. There are economic interests behind almost all of these propositions. They're often hidden, they're often distorted. And I think the answer for voters is to just follow the money. See who has an economic interest in the passage or the non-passage of these propositions and understand what's really going on.
Another thing I wanted to mention, Jeff, was, and this involves both Northern and Southern California and criminal justice reform, is a rather surprising upset, I thought. George Gascon, looking like he's going to prevail for district attorney in Los Angeles over the incumbent Jackie Lacey. And George Gascon was in the L.A. Police Department. Then he headed a police department in Arizona, was then DA in San Francisco. And now it looks like he'll be DA in LA. And he was elected on a progressive platform of not locking up folks and throwing away the key, but looking at rehabilitation and education. And anyway, so that will be interesting to see what happens in LA County with a new DA.
This is something that's happening. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say the surprising thing there is that when Jackie Lacey misstepped and talked about business as usual, when he came out and talked about criminal justice reform and people of color and about the just the way that people are being disproportionately hurt when they're people of color, he snatched her support from both the mayor of L.A. and Governor Newsom, and the whole tide turned. Let me turn it to Dave from San Mateo. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Jeff. This is a great show tonight. I have a question about Prop 25. I'd like to get your guest's opinion on how Prop 25 will affect the local criminal justice system here in the Bay Area. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
And Prop 25, for those who aren't familiar, is the ballot initiative to save the bail industry, cash bail, from what was a demise at the hands of the state legislature. So how is that going to play out here? Dean, Brad, either one of you have a take on that?
The way it's going to play out is that the cash bail system remains in place. And that's, you know, arguably not a very good idea. The whole thrust of this proposition was that income equality has been so great that people who commit heinous crimes but happen to have a large bank account can get out of jail pending resolution of their cases, while people who commit very minor crimes remain in jail just because they don't have enough money in their wallet to pay bail. This seems like something that would be, something that would make things more equal in the criminal justice system. But the politics of this was very unusual. Organizations like the ACLU and the NAACP looked at the cashless bail system as it was proposed and said, hey, everybody's now going to be profiled. And judges will look at a profile and see if you present a risk of flight and if you present a risk of harm to the community. And they did some analysis on these profiles and said the profiles themselves are going to be biased, and people of color are going to wind up disproportionately remaining in jail. And so those organizations came out in opposition to Prop 25 and formed sort of we say politics makes strange bedfellows. I mean, this certainly did. They joined maybe unwittingly with the bail industry that had poured millions of dollars into this process. And the net result was that the bail system, which favors people who are well-heeled, people who are rich, remains in place.
I have a very different take on it, but I want to turn to Brad and give you a chance to respond before I do.
Thank you. Well, I'll defer to Dean as a criminal defense attorney. I don't practice criminal law, although representing political figures and candidates, sometimes I need to refer them to criminal defense lawyers. But what I will say about Prop 25 is it was a referendum. And so, as you probably know, we have the initiative, referendum, and recall as part of our progressive reforms. And an initiative is put on directly by an interest group such as Prop 22, whereas a referendum is a reaction to something the legislature does. It also reaches the ballot by signatures on a petition, but you end up voting yes if you want to affirm what the government did and no if you want to reject it. So it's kind of a different beast than the usual initiative that we're used to.
I have a little different take than my friend Dean when it comes to Prop 25. I think the bail system needs a lot of reform. The big problems I see with the bail system are not the structure of the bail system, but rather with the way it's being used. And frankly, the way that my friends in the courts are setting bails and they're exacerbating the different applications to people at different economic stations from what it should be. And what the legislature did after the legislature, then the courts gave direction right up through and including the California Supreme Court that there were supposed to be adjustments for people who don't have an income or don't have a significant income so that they could still get out, with an idea that it doesn't matter how much money you make. If you have enough stake in the game, you're going to go to court. If you have enough of your own being, enough of your own wealth or whatever it may be invested, you're going to do it. You're going to do what you're supposed to be doing, which is to behave while you're out and to get into court. And the courts instead were setting bails higher and higher, and it created that division between the very wealthy who could get out for anything, including murder. There was somebody recently in a very celebrated case that we discussed here months ago who faced a murder accusation, was given bail, and bailed with a tremendous amount of money. On the other hand, you do have people that have very small things that can't bail out. That's a problem with application. And by shutting down bail entirely, there is no check and balance when bail is no longer available and a judge simply gives a thumbs up or a thumbs down at your arraignment. And if they say you're in, you're in. And there are better solutions potentially than shutting down the bail system entirely. I hope that some of our friends will find them.
Yeah, I think that's what the public said. They said, yeah, we need bail reform, but the system that's being proposed here is just not it. Probably what we're going to wind up with is a system that was suggested by a case called Humphreys, which is taking the ability to pay into account, as you suggest. And that certainly is one way out of the problem of bail inequality.
Well, our time is going to be fairly short, and I'd like to go through a whole bunch of topics in very short order. I also want to avail people the opportunity to call us. We still have some time. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. Tonight we're talking elections, the elections from yesterday, exactly where we are, with Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson and Bradley Hertz, a past president of the California Political Attorneys Association. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. As always, you can call us on anything regarding tonight's topics, the elections, state, federal, where we stand in the presidential election, whatever it may be. You've got a bit of time left that you can call us. One proposition we didn't discuss and we have to give fairly short shrift to because of the time is Proposition 20, which had very little advertisements on either side, and yet it was shot down pretty strongly. That one was sought by certain sectors of law enforcement in order to reverse several referendums and initiatives in recent years and up the ante on some of the charges that have been – where penalties have been lessened. Anything we've learned from that, Brad? Dean?
Again, because that's criminal justice reform, I think Dean would be more instructive than I would be.
Oh, I think that proposition is the pendulum swinging the wrong way. I think it's real clear from all of the criminal justice reforms we've had and from my discussions with and observations of what's going on in the courts that we understand that it's not just bail that needs reform. It's the courts and it's the penal system, the system of punishment altogether. A lot of what's being done in the criminal justice system is just warehousing people. It's putting people away. I think we're beginning to realize that we need more and more in the way of specialized courts to deal with particular problems. We need mental health courts. We need drug courts. People who have a drug problem shouldn't be put in jail. They should get treatment. People who have a mental health problem shouldn't be put in jail. They should get treatment. People who have an alcohol problem perhaps should be kept off the streets, but not necessarily in jail. They should be getting some sort of treatment. Felony charges for minor drug possessions are a waste of everybody's time and effort and resources. I note that in Oregon, for example, there was a proposition on their ballot which passed, which effectively decriminalized possession of small amounts of just about every drug, including heroin and cocaine. I think this proposition is an anachronism. It's a reaction to a trend, but I think that trend is overwhelming.
So let me ask a few questions. We're talking about two different systems at the same time. What can California and the Bay Area learn from what's going on, both at a federal level and a state level?
If we're talking about the election, I think we need to learn some humility. I think a lot of us thought that at the end of the day, people who supported Trump were going to begin to see the error of their ways and they were going to flock away from Trump. That's not the case. I talk to people who are part of the Trump base. I have relatives who are part of that base, and I grew up in that part of the country. And those people are committed. They're passionate. Many of them are coming out to the polls for the first time in their lives. And some of their grievances are legitimate. It's not just that they've been brainwashed by Fox News. You can't do that unless people are really hurting and really feel that they have been betrayed and abandoned by the system. The mission for the next few years is going to be to start to reach out to those people and hopefully have them reach out to us and find common ground.
Brett?
Sure. I was reading, of course, a lot of commentary about the election, and there were a couple of takeaways that I wanted to share. One was, there's a saying about polls, one who lives by the crystal ball winds up getting cut by broken glass. And I think we saw in 2016 and then again now that you can't always trust the polls. People may not be saying what they really will end up doing, or for various other reasons, the pollsters didn't quite get it right. Another aspect is to perhaps time to rethink the Electoral College. And when now it looks like if Biden wins, he will have the popular vote as well as the Electoral College majority. But we haven't seen that in the recent past. And there may be time to restructure that. Also, I think we can all be impressed with voter turnout, as Dean said, especially in a time of COVID when folks are often not comfortable going and waiting in line. We were able to adapt with vote by mail and with a record turnout. And people were relatively well behaved at the polls. I'm down here in LA. I drove by Rodeo Drive, which was all boarded up and cordoned off. And it was a shame because, of course, businesses are struggling anyway, even on Rodeo Drive. And I hope that we won't see unrest when we finally do get a president. And I think lastly, we have to find a way to talk to each other and agree to disagree. I think Biden is able to work across the aisle. And I think more discussion and more knowledge and research is helpful. And finally, as Ben Franklin said in 1787, when he was asked, do we have a monarchy or a republic? He said, a republic, if you can keep it. And I think that's our job, is to keep this young democracy going for our future generations.
Your comments about speaking to each other harken me back to our show 2 weeks ago. But before we go off on that tangent, let me turn it to Daniel from Burlingame. You're on Your Legal Rights. Unfortunately, our time is kind of short. We have just a couple minutes. But Daniel, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I'd like to ask your guests to elaborate a little bit on the L.A. County District Attorney's race. Do they think this is a referendum on criminal justice just in Los Angeles County? What are the implications statewide, and are there any implications nationally? Thank you.
Sure. This is Brad. And by way of disclosure, George Gascon is a client of our firm in terms of helping him with political law issues, campaign finance issues, things like that. So we did have a horse in the race. But I think it's part of a national discussion. We saw, of course, with, we see continued police abuse of citizens, certainly Black American men. And a lot of people say enough is enough. You know, locking them up and throwing away the key is not working. We can't disenfranchise huge groups of our population. We have to figure out a way to think outside the box. And there is a group of criminal justice reformers who opposed Prop 20. They supported Prop 47, I think it was, a few years ago. They supported George Gascon. It's, a balance between safety for citizens and giving people the benefit of the doubt in terms of rehabilitation versus recidivism. So I think it's part of a big trend. And George Gascon will be a litmus test over these next 4 years.
And clearly, if you don't have the mass incarceration, you won't have entire communities that are disenfranchised. if their theory holds, we'll all be safer. Dean, would you?
Daniel, you should know that Bradley's absolutely right. This is part of a national movement. There is an organization called the Open Society Foundation that's working with the American Civil Liberties Union to put progressive candidates up for the office of district attorney. They've been successful in a number of district attorney races. And the impetus behind this is the realization that district attorneys are incredibly powerful in terms of a public official that affects your daily life. There are very few people that are comparable to your district attorney. He or she can sign a complaint and by the stroke of a pen can file a court paper that can wreck your life. And that's an extraordinary amount of power that district attorneys have over citizens on a day-to-day basis. And they are enormously important. So yes, this is part of the national movement. It's part of a much broader trend in criminal justice reform, and it's going to grow.
Just add to that, they can also decide not to prosecute police officers. And that was one of the criticisms of Jackie Lacey.
With that, we're essentially out of time. I wanted to give each of you between 2 and 3 minutes for any closing thoughts.
Dean, go right ahead.
Go, Brad. You after you.
Okay. Well, my five takeaways I thought was my conclusion, but as a lawyer, I'm always able and willing to speak more. Looking at the election as an election law practitioner, but also as a husband and a father and hopefully grandfather one day, it really meant a lot to me how the young people came out to vote and how interested and kind of activated people are. My 21-year-old was texting about the Electoral College and how many votes, how many electoral votes does Georgia have? And people are enthused, maybe also a little scared in a way they haven't been. But as Dean said, a stress test on democracy is often a healthy thing. I think our debate and dialogue in Washington, D.C., I hope will get healthier. And, with regard to elections themselves, it really comes down to the human factor. We don't just push one button and have everybody's vote tabulated. It is a messy process, just like democracy itself is a messy process. But there is often not or has not been evidence of sufficient fraud to cast doubt on, large scale elections. You're certainly going to have imperfections. You might have actual fraud here and there, which is, of course, unacceptable. But as far as casting doubt on the entire election, which our current president is trying to do, I think that's a disservice to democracy. I encourage people to vote, to stay involved, even though it's a big effort to learn the issues every 2 years, but to vote, and especially in California, where we have an active democracy and less two-party rule than some would like, it's still so important to stay involved. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, Jeff. Thank you.
Brad, thank you. Dean, we're down to about two and a half minutes max.
Easy. I can just tell everyone that what's been going through my mind during this whole election process is the quote from Abraham Lincoln, which is, "A house divided cannot stand." We are deeply divided at this point, and at multiple levels. We're divided on the state level. Our legislatures are Republican, our governors are Democrat in key states. We're divided between urban and rural constituencies. You can see when you look where the maps are blue and where the maps are red, that there's a difference between an urban civilization and a rural civilization. We're divided in our Congress, where there's a Democratic House of Representatives and a Republican Senate. We're divided on values. That house divided cannot stand. The mission for every one of us from now until election and beyond is to start reaching out and embracing those people who see the world differently from us and realize that we all have legitimate grievances and we all have grievances in common that we can address. Those people on the other side aren't going away, and they're half of America, and they're entrenched and they're passionate about their beliefs, and they have some legitimate legitimate grievances. So we need to start listening to people who see the world differently than we do. I have a sister who is part of the Republican base. She's an evangelical Christian, a fervent supporter of Donald Trump. And I was going to gloat if Joe Biden won. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to reach out and I'm going to include her and I'm going to say, okay, what are your concerns? How can we go forward together? And I'm going to remind her that there are things that are more important than day-to-day politics. There's family and there's friends and there's fellow citizens and there's our democratic institutions and we deserve all of those.
I join you in that. I think those comments were very heartfelt and very important at this point, irrespective of who wins the election. And I say that knowing who I pretty clearly support and my brother, who is very dear to me, joined a caravan and drove with a pro-Trump caravan for 100 miles on Sunday. We have divisions within our own households, much like at the time of the Civil War. We have to get a handle on that and start talking about it with one another and the things that are important to us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've looked for a little closure on the election. It has yet to be seen whether we've attained any. Our guest tonight have been Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson and past president of the California Political Attorneys Association, Bradley Hertz. Next week, again at our new time, 6 o'clock, a program you won't want to miss, as we discuss COVID-19 and the Bill of Rights. Once again, thank you to our guests, Bradley Hertz and Dean Johnson. Thank you both for joining us. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy. And our thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Once again, 415-989-1616 or sfbar.org.